Hey, it's Mae Whitman, and I play Frankie in the new Realm podcast, The Sisters. The Sisters is about a museum curator of medical oddities who investigates the origins of a mutated skeleton with two layers of bones. Soon, she uncovers an extraordinary mystery that connects her present with one family's tragic past in hauntingly dangerous ways. Listen to The Sisters wherever you get your podcasts.
Anything but human. One. It's nothing personal, they told him. Just part of our wider streamlining efforts. But to Remy, it felt very personal. He was a person. A person with needs. Expenses. And he was being replaced by a computer program. How could that not be personal? For 7 years, Remy had been committed to his role at Fusion Tech, a company that, now that he thought about it, sounded like it had been named by a computer program. And now, that bold and innovative company was taking the next step in its evolution. The step where it replaced its marketing department with lifeless technology. They called it AI, but only because every basic automation program was called AI now. It could generate passable marketing copy, create generic logos and designs, and even emulate the soulless allure of stock photography. It was a one-stop shop for all of Fusion Tech's marketing needs. And, as such, Remy's role as copywriter, along with the graphic design team, the SEO team, and even some of marketing's management positions, were all dissolved. Worse yet, Remy had been given the news while he was on his way home from a business trip. He had been sent to a tech convention in Minneapolis that weekend, and the call had come just as he was about to board his flight home to St. George. He would spend the next 2.5 hours cramped in a stuffy fuselage, seemingly surrounded on all sides by crying children. He tried to stay serene, reaching into his bag and pulling out The Stranger by Albert Camus, one of several books he'd been trying to finish in recent months. But no matter how much he tried to focus on the page, the words found no purchase in his head. The only thoughts that could survive in the toxic atmosphere of his mind were those of rage and resignation. In fact, if the plane he was on began hurtling toward the ground, he likely would have welcomed it. His plane didn't crash, though. It landed, as planned, at St. George Regional and taxied up to one of the airport's few small gates. When he disembarked, Remy did not go to baggage claim to collect his bag. He could care less about the dress shirts, the leftover pamphlets, and the Fusion Tech-branded laptop his bag contained. He just kept walking, pushing through the crowded terminal until he got outside. He walked straight to his car and climbed into it. Then he started the engine and pulled out of his spot. He would later tell the judge that he didn't know what he was about to do until he did it, that it just sort of happened. But the truth of the matter wasn't that he was unaware of his actions. He knew, at least on some level, what he was doing. He had merely lost concern for the potential consequences his actions could bring. As he accelerated toward the airport's exit, he saw a red and white striped barricade extended across the road ahead. A little metal kiosk stood next to it, the sign above it reading, "Pay all parking fees before exiting. $7 per day. Cash and card accepted." He knew he was supposed to stop, to present his parking stub and pay the fee, to wait for the arm of the barricade to slowly lift so he could pass underneath. But as he continued to accelerate, he found that he simply couldn't comply with those demands. And it wasn't about the $14, either. It was about the principle. Not one more time could he enter his PIN. Not one more time could he sign on the dotted line. Not one more time could he agree to the updated terms and conditions, or answer a quick customer survey. He was done. The wooden arm of the barricade splintered into 1,000 pieces, making a deeply satisfying crack as the hood of his car smashed through it. A few pieces of debris clung to the bottom of his windshield, and he toggled the windshield wipers, eventually coaxing them to skitter away in the wind. When he got out onto the highway, he rolled down his window and took a deep breath. He felt free. But like any good thing, that feeling of freedom only lasted so long. Only a few days later, he received an envelope in the mail. The letter inside, which came from the sheriff's office, explained that he had a court date scheduled, and that he was required to appear or else forfeit his driver's license. Amusingly, the letter was accompanied by a page labeled "Evidence" in bold black letters. Below the word was a picture, clearly taken from a security camera. It showed his Nissan at the precise moment it shattered the barricade, reducing the wooden plank to a constellation of splinters, all of them accelerating outward like a blast wave from a detonation. Of course, in the bottom right corner of the picture, his license plate was clearly in view. Still, the image made Remy grin. He thought he might have to get it framed. When he appeared in court, Remy was told he would have to pay a fine to replace the barricade, and that he would be given a strike on his driving record. If he couldn't afford the fine, or simply didn't wish to pay it, he was also given the option of serving 40 hours of community service. Or, of course, there was always the third option, of not doing either and letting the repercussions catch up with him when they may. But Remy's senses had mostly returned to him by then. He didn't want any more trouble over the matter. And now that he was out of a job, large expenses were best to be avoided. So, he decided to serve the community service hours. 2. The following Monday morning, he showed up at the Department of Transportation office as requested. There, he was given a hard hat and a bright orange vest, and along with a handful of other lucky community advocates, he would board a van that would take them out along the highway to clean up trash. The van pulled out of the lot and drove for a while, and then the driver pulled off near a drainage ditch, and Remy and the others got out. Each of them got a trash bag and a mechanical grabber tool with a hand lever on one end and little metal jaws on the other. It reminded Remy of the one his grandmother used to pick up the newspaper from the front porch after her back gave out. He took it and walked lazily along the highway, picking up receipts and cigarette butts and sun-bleached Starbucks cups. The constant stream of passing cars drew fine desert dust into the air, and it caked the edges of Remy's nostrils. When they had lifted most of the visible trash from the area, they climbed back into the van and drove to the next spot. They repeated this process several times, stopping at various points along the highway where rubbish tended to accumulate, gradually moving further out of town and into the surrounding desert. At their fifth stop of the day, which Remy hoped would be their last, he got out of the van and began maneuvering through the sand and the brush. He would clamp a rock or a twig with his grabber, thrust it into the air, and watch it arc back down to the earth. As he hurled a small branch skyward, he noticed a sprawling hotel complex just up ahead. It consisted of two long rectangular buildings, connected at the front by a lobby with a low, slanting roof. It was all glass and stucco, the walls painted a red clay color that meshed seamlessly with the surrounding desert. A few dozen palm trees had been planted around the perimeter of the property, and a tall neon sign stood in the parking lot out front. The Western Sentinel, Inn and Suites, it read. He was surprised that he had just then noticed it. The highway was rather barren otherwise, and, having lived in St. George for quite a few years, he had grown familiar with most of the establishments along the highway. But he supposed that it was probably newly built. And besides, he didn't come out that way all too often. He was about to turn and mosey back to the van when he noticed a bright yellow sign posted near the hotel's entrance. "Now hiring. Night security," the sign read. As he walked back to the van, he imagined himself in the role. "Who, me? I just work nighttime security at a local hotel," he thought, trying the title on for size. It wasn't exactly a label he'd be proud of, but it still sounded better than telling people he was unemployed. And what other choices did he have? He could look for another content writing job, but how long would that last? How long would it take his next employer to replace him with a nonsense-spewing AI program? 3. While he slept that night, he had a dream that was like his situation, but not his situation. In the dream, Remy had been fired from his job at a bowling alley, and he was considering applying for a role as an assistant to a private investigator. He was standing outside the private investigator's office, but something was stopping him from going inside. He felt as though some kind of strange and horrible fate awaited him if he went through with applying for the role. But he didn't know what this strange and horrible fate was. Something vague and menacing that lingered just outside his view. When he woke up the following morning, he didn't know what to make of the dream. He had never worked in a bowling alley, nor had he ever considered working for a private investigator. But the dream still seemed like it could be somewhat pertinent to his situation. Was it meant to be a warning? A cautionary signal? Or did it mean anything at all? Was it, like so many other dreams he'd had, nothing more than a random hallucination conjured by his feelings and experiences? As he sat on the edge of his bed, he considered what he should do that day. He thought about serving more of his community service hours, but then he thought about how much money was in his bank account, how much food was in his fridge, how much gas was in his car. He decided instead to drive down to the Western Sentinel and see about the security job. The dream may have been a bit unsettling, but it didn't make him any less unemployed. And besides, he'd been given 60 days to complete his community service. That he could sort out in time. But establishing a new stream of income was a concern of more immediate consequence. He put on the only collared shirt he had that wasn't wrinkled and pulled on his best pair of thrift store slacks. And then he got in his car and drove down Highway 9 to the hotel. When he arrived, he walked inside and saw a desk on the far wall made of fine, polished concrete. Slick brown tile covered the floor of the lobby, and a pair of mid-century modern chairs sat empty in one corner. On one wall hung a large Bauhaus-style painting. Remy saw a woman appear from a door behind the desk. She had long hair that was frizzy and graying in streaks. Thick-framed glasses rested on her nose, and her cheeks were slightly rosy around the cheekbone. "Can I help you?" she asked. "Yes," Remy said. "I'm looking for the manager." "That's me," she said. "What can I do for you?" "Well, my name is Remy Moreau," he said. "I'm here to inquire about your night security position." "Oh, yes," she said. "Well, nice to meet you, Remy. My name is Dana. I'm the general manager." She looked around the empty room. "I suppose if you have a few minutes, we can step back into my office and talk about the position." Remy nodded, and she led him through the door behind the desk. They walked down a hall and into a small but neat office. Inside was a desk with a few chairs on either side. But it was a standing desk, and was set far too high to make sitting appropriate. So Remy and Dana stood on opposite sides of it, while Dana pressed the button to lower the desk. With a mechanical buzz, the desk slowly descended. And as it did, they faced each other awkwardly, gradually crouching into their chairs. "So, did the old nighttime security guard leave?" Remy asked as the desk finally bottomed out. "Well, actually," Dana said, "we didn't have an old nighttime security guard. We've only been open for a few months." She opened the lid of a laptop that sat on her desk, swiping her fingers across the trackpad as she spoke. "But we've had a few minor incidents, and we thought we'd be better off with a dedicated security staff. We already hired someone for the day shift, so now we just need to fill the night shift." "Incidents?" Remy asked, surprised at how smoothly she'd glazed over the topic. "Minor incidents," she corrected. "You know, people not paying their bill, kids throwing parties." "Of course," Remy said. "Like I said, we're new," she told him. "But, being as close as we are to Zion National Park, we host our fair share of travelers. The vast majority of them are civil, honest, accountable. But, like any business, we sometimes have customers that are liabilities to us." "Right," Remy said, though he had doubts about whether he understood exactly what she meant. "So, tell me," she said. "What makes you interested in this role?" "Well, I'm always looking for new opportunities," Remy said. "And of course, I need a job." "You're not currently employed?" she asked. "I was recently laid off," he told her. "I worked in marketing, content writing, but I was replaced by a language model." "I see," she said sympathetically. "I understand it's not the most relevant experience to this position," Remy went on, "but I really think I'd be good at it. I'm observant and punctual, and I've always had a knack for de-escalation." Dana nodded agreeably. "And when could you start?" she asked. "As soon as you need me," he told her. "Okay," she said, typing something into her laptop. The two of them spoke a few minutes longer. She explained the basic duties of the security guard, making hourly rounds of the property, watching for suspicious behavior on the security cameras. Remy nodded along, noting that he was good with computers and even familiar with some video editing software. "And, of course, you'd have to write out incident reports whenever an altercation or disagreement occurs," she said. "Well, writing is something I'm definitely accustomed to," he interjected. "But it must be said," she told him, raising her palms as if to signify the importance of what she was about to say, "that if any serious incident ever occurs, your duty will always be to call 911. We would never ask you to intervene in a situation that would put your life or your safety at risk." "Understood," he told her. "Well," she said, looking at the petite silver watch on her wrist, I think I should get back to the front desk. But I really appreciate you coming in. She reached her hand out to shake his. They shook, her grip surprisingly firm. And then she reached into a drawer in her desk and retrieved a business card, handing it to him. Here's my card, she said. How about you send me your resume when you get a chance and I'll be in touch. Certainly, he told her, glancing at the card before slipping it into his pocket. 4. On the drive home, he felt pleased with himself. I think it went well, he thought. Dana seemed impressed with how he'd presented himself and what he'd told her. He supposed that was why he'd gotten into content writing in the first place, because he knew how to put words together in a way that sounded meaningful. But was it really meaningful? Or was it just confident-sounding gibberish? Not unlike the gibberish produced by AI programs. It must have been meaningful on some level, though, because a few days after he'd emailed Dana his resume, she called him, excitedly announcing that she'd like to offer him the job. He could start the week after next, she said, if that worked for his schedule. Yes, he told her. That works great. When he hung up the phone, he was somewhat surprised. He had half expected her to write back saying he had failed the background check. Destruction of public property is not something we want our security staff to be noted for, he had imagined her email saying. Perhaps, he thought, they hadn't performed a background check. Or maybe they just didn't care. Regardless, he knew that if they didn't mention his recent incident, he certainly wouldn't either. He was also intent on completing as much of his community service time as possible before he started at the Western Sentinel. Picking up trash on the side of the highway was a nuisance even after a night of restful sleep. He didn't want to try it after spending all night at work. He spent the following Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday completing his community service hours. It was still springtime, the heat not yet vicious, but it was enough to pull thick beads of sweat from his skin as he prodded the roadside, slowly filling his bag with scraps of refuse. He spent Friday resting, and over the weekend he began to acquaint himself with his new sleeping schedule. He slept through the days and stayed awake all night, and when Monday evening came, he was ready to begin his first shift. When he arrived, he was given a simple black uniform, a flashlight, and a canister of pepper spray, which he was encouraged not to use unless completely necessary. The first couple nights, the daytime security guard, Paul, stayed on for the first few hours of Remy's shift. He showed Remy how to use the surveillance system, accessing and monitoring the camera footage. He went through the process of conducting patrols and writing incident reports. Although, Paul admitted, a lot of the job is just sitting around, being prepared in the case that something does happen. Remy didn't mind the sitting around, though. Some people in his position might have felt ashamed, going from a salaried desk job to being a bona fide hall monitor. But Remy actually liked the change. He enjoyed having a slower pace and simpler expectations, enjoyed having time to think. And he was even allowed to bring a book and read between making his rounds. When he wasn't reading, he was happy just sitting and watching the camera feeds. He found a curious sort of joy in seeing people go on about their lives, unaware, or at least unconcerned about the fact that they were being watched. There was something enchanting, something subtle yet pure in the way they moved, the way they carried their luggage around and talked to each other. Who are these people? He wondered. Where are they from? Where are they going? Perhaps it wasn't his place to know. His job was only to sit back and observe, to watch the banality unfold. But then, One night, just as he was getting used to the dull predictability of his new occupation, something unexpected happened. Something he couldn't fully explain. He was sitting in the room they called the security office, which really was little more than a closet. It had no windows, but contained two chairs and a desk, on top of which sat a multi-screen CCTV monitoring station. It was just after 3 a.m, and Remy was seated at the desk, reading and occasionally glancing at the feeds from one of the hotel's 12 security cameras. He had finally moved on from The Stranger, and was now reading Steppenwolf by Hermann Hesse. As he flipped a page, he looked up at the screen. 5. Something's different, Remy thought, his eyes dodging back and forth between the two computer screens. He knew something had changed. Something was there that hadn't been there before. Or perhaps something that had been there before was now gone. He knew so because the camera feeds were mostly static this time of night. He had glanced at the monitors 50 times in the past few hours and hadn't seen a single person walking the grounds, a single car maneuvering the parking lot. He had become so accustomed to the stagnant surveillance feeds that the contents of all 12 little boxes on the screen had been subconsciously stamped as familiar in his mind. But now something looked unfamiliar. And eventually, he realized what it was. Upstairs, in Wing A, there was a shadow. A form, could he call it? Perhaps, but not quite a figure. Not quite human. It was inert, seeming to cling to the corner at the end of the hall. It stretched like a column from floor to ceiling. But it wasn't perfectly upright. It was slightly crooked, like a person hunched over, their head leaning into the apex of the corner. But it can't be a person, he thought to himself. What kind of person is as tall as the ceiling? It was probably nothing, he insisted to himself. Just a shadow that the hallway lights failed to reach. He was simply assigning human-like characteristics to the shadow. His brain, trying to make sense of random shapes in the dark, was adding detail where no detail existed. Still, he slowly rose from his seat, placing his palms on the desk and leaning in toward the screen. But just as he got close to it, the room was plunged into darkness. He turned, knocking his book to the floor and jolting slightly as it hit the ground. Pulling his flashlight from its holster on his belt, he opened the door and left the room. He stumbled down the hotel's darkened hallways, not sure what to do. Should he call somebody? He didn't know. Power outage response wasn't part of his training. And, in truth, he wasn't thinking of his training at all. His mind was still back in the security office, trying to recall what he'd seen just before the screens went dark. He was almost certain he had witnessed something, some kind of movement from the form in the final seconds before it disappeared. But was that just the screen glitching as the pixels flickered out? Or had the movement been real? He felt as though he had seen the movement somewhere near the top of the form, a kind of spinning, like the turning of a head. But it wasn't quite like the turning of a head. It was more like the spinning of a globe, or the twisting of a tennis ball hung from a string. It rotated smoothly on its axis, as opposed to the restricted and irregular movement caused by the turning of an appendage. At least, he thought it did. But what did he see when it spun around? What did the turning reveal? A face of some kind? Perhaps, but he couldn't recall. The whole memory was rough, uncertain. But the very end of it was especially abstruse. It reminded him of a time, several years before, when he'd been in Missoula and had seen a pedestrian get hit by a car. He was only standing 15 or so feet away, saw the whole thing happen. But it wasn't until several seconds after that he realized what he'd seen. It was only after the woman's head had left a blood-stained crack on the car's windshield, after her body had cartwheeled through the air, her tennis shoes flying off in two separate directions. It was after she had come back down to the pavement with a wet thud that he realized what he'd seen. Only then did adrenaline fill his system. Only then did he rush over and try to help. The whole time she was whirling limply through the air, he couldn't grasp what he was seeing. It was as if his mind couldn't comprehend the viciousness of the impact or the ensuing contortion of her body without seeing where she lay as a result, bleeding and folded over in the gutter. Her resting image was needed for his brain to make sense of the violent journey she took to get there. Everything before that was just the incomprehensible movement of various random shapes. Seeing that movement, that turning on the screen, made him feel the same way he felt when he saw the woman get hit by the car. But he didn't have a resting image. There was no body on the pavement that he could look at to determine what had happened. No conclusion that he could draw from to add context to what he'd just seen. There was only the pitch-black walls that surrounded him. 6. The power had been out for several minutes by then, and Remy was in the process of deciding whether to call Dana and ask her what to do. He was holding his phone in his hands when the power suddenly returned, the lights flickering back to life. He slipped his phone into his pocket and breathed a shallow sigh of relief. It had probably been nothing, but he decided that in the interest of being thorough, he would fill out an incident report about the power outage, just so that if someone asked him about it later, he would have proof that he hadn't simply dozed off at his desk and slept through it. He went back to his office and sat down at the desk to write his report. The monitors in front of him were in the process of rebooting, and when they came back online, he looked up from the paper he was scribbling on and inspected the feed from camera number 7, the camera in the upstairs hallway where the apparent form had been. When he looked at the place where he thought the shadowy shape had stood, he was surprised to find it wasn't there. Or, not exactly that it wasn't there, but that it was less there. But how can something be less there, he thought to himself. It's either there or it isn't. But this couldn't be so crudely scrutinized. He couldn't readily compare what he'd seen, or thought he'd seen, before the power outage, to what he was looking at now. Yes, there was a shadow in the corner of the hallway. But was it the same shadow? It didn't look so menacing now. He could have sworn it had been more voluminous, more murky, and somehow, at the same time, more detailed. But what had it been a detailed image of? What did it actually look like? If it wasn't a person, then what was it? He thought again about the last few seconds before the power went out, about the apparent turning of its head. And head was a term he used only because he didn't know what else to call it. He pictured the movement, smooth and almost mechanical, like the sliding open of elevator doors or the spinning of a bowling ball on one end. But instead of having three holes on its face, something else was there. Face was also a term he used hesitantly, because he didn't remember what was on it, whether it could even be called a face. Certainly there was nothing resembling a face on the screen now. He told himself that he had only imagined it, but when he finished his report and got up to do his rounds a few minutes later, he was still nervous as he approached Wing A's upstairs hallway. He opened the hallway door and slowly walked inside, but he didn't see anything out of the ordinary. There was a shadow in the corner that Camera 7 was pointed toward, probably caused by the strangely patterned ceiling lights. But it was only a shadow. There was nothing inside of it, nothing concealed by its darkness. Cautiously, he walked over to the corner and ran his fingers down the seam where one wall met the other. It just felt like a normal wall. The paint fresh, the brush strokes clean and even. Remy looked over his shoulder at the empty hallway behind him, listened to the silence that filled the space, and then he turned and left. 7. 2 days after the night of the power outage, Remy arrived at work to find Dana in the security office. "There you are," she said. "Am I late?" Remy asked, looking down at his wrist before realizing he wasn't wearing a watch. "No," she said. "I was just about to head home, but I wanted to come by and ask you to take care of something." "What is it?" Remy asked. Dana pulled a note from her pocket and read from it. "The guest in 21A, she said, "Roger Thorpe. His stay came to an end today, but he never checked out. Would you mind going into that room and clearing it out? We need it for a party checking in tomorrow morning." "All right," Remy said. "You can just put the stuff in the storage closet next to the laundry room," she said, standing to leave. "He can collect it whenever he shows up and pays the tab." Remy nodded. "Well, thanks," she said, opening the door and walking out. "Have a good night." As he left the office and walked over to the A-wing, his nerves returned. Wasn't 21A near where he'd seen the shadowy form? He climbed the stairs and opened the door to the hallway, seeing that, in fact, it was. He wondered how Dana knew the guest was gone. How could he be certain that nobody would be inside? Perhaps Paul had seen them leave on the security camera that morning. But if that was the case, why didn't she say so? Remy reasoned that they had probably come looking for Mr. Thorpe about settling his bill, but he hadn't answered. And so they concluded that the room was empty, which would make sense. After all, the Do Not Disturb sign still hung from the doorknob. But what if the room wasn't empty? He felt for his pepper spray canister on his hip, just to make sure it was there. To be cautious, he knocked twice on the door and then stood back. As he did, he found his eyes wandering over to the corner where he thought he'd seen the fleeting shape. "Security," he said loudly. He waited 30 seconds or so. When there was no answer, he reached into his pocket, retrieved his master key card, and held it to the sensor above the doorknob. He was determined to get the belongings, pack them up, and get back out as fast as possible. But as soon as he opened the door and stepped inside, something stopped him. The room was empty, or nearly empty. There didn't appear to be any people inside. But sitting on the table in the far corner of the room was a laptop. The laptop screen was divided into 6 boxes, each displaying what looked at first like a static image. But as he got closer, he could see that they were video feeds, not unlike the feeds from the hotel security cameras. But instead of showing parking lots and hallways, These cameras were trained on a house. Each camera was pointed at a window, zoomed in and focused to reveal a surprising amount of detail. It looks like Roger Thorpe is doing surveillance on someone, Remy thought. He looked around the room. Aside from the computer, there wasn't much there. A black backpack sat on a chair. Remy looked inside and saw it was empty, aside from a few power cables. In the bathroom, there was a toothbrush and an unopened bottle of mouthwash. He walked back out to the living area and looked at the computer. A woman had moved into view now. Remy could see her in the house's kitchen. He placed his palms on the table and leaned in to get a better look at her. She had shoulder-length hair that was dark, but not black, bangs that hung down to her eyebrows. She wore a cream-colored blouse and a slim skirt that hit it mid-thigh. Remy leaned in closer, watching her as she appeared to prepare a meal. He wondered why someone would want to spy on her. Was she a suspect in some high-profile crime? She didn't look like a criminal. Though he supposed there were many types of crimes and many types of criminals. Perhaps a jealous lover was having her watched, suspecting her of infidelity. But it did seem a little elaborate for that. Remy had never set up spy equipment before, but he suspected that securing 6 different angles of a house's interior, all without tipping off one's mark, would require precision and meticulous planning. Remy's eyes followed the woman as she walked from the kitchen to the dining room, a glass in one hand. "Why are they watching you?" he whispered. 8. If someone had asked him what he was thinking, he probably would have answered that he wasn't. He was only acting faithfully on the strange impulse that had blossomed in his mind. For the remainder of his shift, he had run his actions through his head, making sure he hadn't missed anything, hadn't let anyone see. He had been careful, gently placing the laptop and the mobile Wi-Fi router that accompanied it inside the backpack. But he had been sure not to let the lid of the laptop close. He carried the backpack to the storage closet, and when he got inside, he cautiously pulled the laptop out and plugged it into one of the outlets on the wall, checking to make sure the screen was still lit. He reasoned that since the computer's display was still on when he'd found it in 21A, it must be set up to never go to sleep or shut off, to continue broadcasting the camera feeds indefinitely as long as it continued to receive a signal. So, given he never closed the lid or let it run out of battery, it would continue to display the video footage, and he wouldn't be forced to enter a passcode or log back in. He left, locking the storage closet door behind him. And in the last few minutes of his shift, about an hour before sunrise, he returned to the closet. Just as he had expected, the laptop screen was still on, the footage still running. He knelt before it, unplugging it from the wall and then untucking his shirt. Then he slid the laptop under his shirt, like an open book pressed against his stomach. He stuffed the power cords and the router into his pockets, holding his forearms stiffly against his hips so the laptop wouldn't slip free. He walked awkwardly out to his car, which was parked just out of view from the parking lot cameras. Once there, he placed the computer gently in his trunk. He had orchestrated this intricate routine so that the hotel security cameras would show him carrying the backpack to the storage room and leaving empty-handed, just as he was asked. Sure, his return trip to the storage closet hours later may look suspicious, but there, he would also be seen leaving, apparently, empty-handed. If anyone asked him why he'd gone back to the room, he could simply tell them that he'd forgotten to lock the door, that he'd gone back to lock it before he went home. He clocked out and drove home as the rising sun began to ignite the sky. He was nervous, and the fear excited him. Under the pink light of morning, he pulled into his apartment complex. He parked his car and stealthily transported the laptop to his upstairs unit. Although he'd been careful not to leave any obvious evidence on the hotel security cameras, he was still afraid the laptop's owner could track its location and come find him. But he also suspected that the reason Roger Thorpe was conducting surveillance from inside a hotel room was because what he was doing wasn't exactly legal. So, what really could Mr. Thorpe say to Remy? Give me back my illegal surveillance equipment? And even though Remy had reservations about whether Roger Thorpe, or whoever was behind this, was the kind of person he should be messing with, the fear still took a back seat to the excitement. In fact, if anything, the fear enhanced his excitement, made him feel like a character in an espionage story. He set the computer down on a desk in his bedroom. The woman being filmed was just appearing to wake up, moving slowly about her bedroom. She must be in a similar time zone to mine, Remy thought. He searched through the computer's files and internet search history, wondering if some information about her may be found there. But there was nothing. He sat down at his desk and watched her get ready for her day. She had on a black t-shirt and a pair of shorts that might have been boxers. Yawning, she walked into the frame of camera number 2 and leaned over the sink to brush her teeth. If he had been a character in a movie, Remy knew, this would be the part where he would become aroused and touch himself, revealing his predatory sexual nature. But what he was doing wasn't merely for perverse enjoyment. He found her attractive, yes, but he told himself that wasn't his reason for taking the laptop. It was something else, an unbridled curiosity, a frightened wonder. But did that make him any better than a simple pervert? Not really. He was still being a voyeur, was still observing someone in a personal setting without their explicit consent. Yet, while he knew it was wrong, creepy even, he couldn't look away from the screen. For a moment, the woman walked back into the frame of camera number 1, which showed her bedroom. Then she walked through the frame of camera number 3 and into the frames of cameras 4, 5, and 6, which showed her downstairs living area. He studied the details of each frame, searching for any clue that could reveal who, or possibly even where, she was. But there was nothing that he could see, at least nothing that he could see clearly enough to differentiate the house from any other house in America. In fact, he wasn't even certain it was in America. It was a surprisingly neat home, almost oddly so. It was entirely clear of clutter, and appeared to contain very few personal items. There were no pictures on the walls, no books or magazines on the counters, and only simple cooking implements in the kitchen. It appeared that nobody else lived there with her, at least nobody that Remy had seen. He still wondered what it was that made her worthy of being so closely surveilled. And then he thought about the fact that he was the one surveilling her, and for a moment he became somewhat uncomfortable. He asked himself what it was that made him so enjoy watching people. Had he been made voyeuristic by social media and the overly transparent modern world? Or was this just how he was? The woman pulled her hair into a ponytail and then walked out of the frame. Remy waited for her to return, but she didn't reappear. Did she leave the house? He wondered. He didn't think so. The door, he presumed to be the front door, was in the view of camera number 6, and she hadn't gone through it. Maybe she was just somewhere where the cameras couldn't see her. He continued to stare at the screen, growing increasingly tired as morning turned to day. Eventually, he walked over to his bed and flopped down on it. But he laid on his side so he could continue to watch the screen. He fell asleep, still waiting for her to come back. 9. When Remy awoke, night had fallen. He checked his phone, making sure he wasn't late for work. He still had an hour before he had to leave. He looked over at the laptop, its soft glow the only source of light in his apartment. Rolling out of bed, he sat before the screen, studying it to see if the woman had returned. It took his eyes a few minutes to adjust, but eventually, he spotted her. She was in bed. She wasn't sleeping, though. She was just sitting, her legs dangling over the edge of the mattress. Remy couldn't tell what she was doing. She appeared to simply be staring at the wall in front of her. She remained perfectly still, hands resting at her sides. It hardly even seemed like she was breathing. Remy squinted his eyes slightly, searching for detail on the dim screen. And then he saw something that looked eerily familiar. In the house's upstairs hallway, on camera number 3, was a peculiar-looking shadow. It appeared identical to the phantom-like shape he'd seen at the hotel before the power outage. But that's impossible, Remy thought. It can't be the same shadow. A single shadow can't appear in 2 different places. That's because it's not a shadow, said a voice in his head. It was too irregular, too intricately detailed to be a shadow. In fact, it almost looked like it was casting a shadow itself. The form loitered in the corner of the woman's hallway, its head pressed against the wall. If it even was a head. Remy wanted to see if he could enlarge the video feed. He placed his finger on the trackpad, but what he felt wasn't the trackpad. It wasn't the computer at all. It felt like the ignition of his car. He looked down and saw a dashboard, a steering wheel. He was in his car. Looking through the windshield, he saw the parking lot of the Western Sentinel. He was at work. "How did I get here?" he said aloud, jumping slightly at the sound of his own voice. He looked at the clock on his dash and saw that his shift was about to start. A full hour had passed in what seemed like a few minutes. Had he gotten ready and driven all the way to work without realizing it? He was deeply shaken, but he didn't have time to sit there and try and figure out what happened. He got out of his car and began to walk inside. As he did, he noticed Dana leaving. "Hi, Remy," she said, fumbling through her purse. "Hey, Dana," he said. He stopped and looked back at her after she passed. "Did that Roger Thorpe guy ever come pick up his stuff?" he asked. She half turned. "Who?" she asked, still digging through her purse for a few seconds before finally finding her car keys. "Oh yeah, 21A, she said. "No, he hasn't come back." "Huh," Remy said casually. "Well, have a good night." He walked over to the security office and clocked in. For the entirety of his shift, he felt on edge. He lingered on those final moments at home, staring at the computer screen before suddenly finding himself at work. What had occurred between those 2 moments? He tunneled through his memory, but whatever had happened remained hidden from him. It was as if his reality had been cut clean and taped back together an hour later. He sat at his desk, watching the monitors. He wondered what was being displayed on the laptop back at his apartment. Was that crooked, shadowy form still there? was the woman still sitting motionless at the edge of her bed. His shift crawled by, its slow passage marked only by his hourly rounds. Every time he circled the parking lot, it seemed like he burned through half a dozen cigarettes. Enough to make his hands start shaking, anyway. When the night was finally over, he clocked out and sped home. He raced up the steps to his apartment and hurried inside. The laptop sat on his bedroom desk, just as he had left it. The video on the screen showed the house in golden morning light. He was relieved to see that the murky form was gone. But it appeared that the woman was gone as well. Her bed still made, as if it hadn't even been slept in. While he waited for her to reappear, he scrolled the news feed on his phone absently. He wondered if his interest in the woman had become an obsession. At what point did someone stop being curious about something and start being obsessed? What exactly constituted an obsession? Was it when it was the only thing you could think about? As he glanced up from his phone, Remy saw the woman appear from around a corner. She was walking slowly, slightly hunched as if she was ill. She took another staggering step forward. And then she stopped and turned slightly, her head lifting. "Is she looking at the camera?" Remy wondered. It seemed as though she was. Her head was angled directly at him, eyes wide and unblinking. There was a complete absence of emotion in her expression. There was no fear, no desire, no pain, no contentment. But there was something in her eyes, a troubling sharpness, an awareness that was dipped in apathy. Slowly, but with clear deliberation, she lifted her right arm, flattening her palm, as if to wave to him. Remy tumbled backwards out of his chair. He thought he might have screamed, but shock had fogged his memory. He gathered himself, picking his phone up off the ground. He glanced at it, still open to his local news feed. It was immediately clear that there was something of significance on the screen. One of the headlines was screaming out at him, but he had to read it several times before the words finally clicked, and he understood why. Ex-intelligence official Roger Thorpe found dead. Ex-intelligence official Roger Thorpe found dead. Intelligence official Roger Thorpe found dead. Remy clicked on the article and read the opening. Mystery today as a man noted for working in intelligence has been found dead in the desert just outside St. George. Roger Thorpe, whose career included work for both the CIA and the Department of Homeland Security, was just 57 at the time of his death. The police are yet to release a cause of death or any other details, noting that the investigation is ongoing. 10. Remy slammed the laptop shut, the woman on the screen still seeming to stare directly at him. And was she smiling now? He wasn't going to check. He was done with whatever was going on in that surveillance footage. He had turned over a rock and found something underneath, waiting to bite him. He grabbed the laptop and the router, threw them under his arm, and walked swiftly out to his car. He drove south for a while, weaving between dusty slabs of sandstone, and then pulled off onto a dirt road. He took the road down to a secluded bank of the Virgin River, parking under a wall of arundo plants. His heart thumping like a kick drum, Remy heaved the laptop out of his trunk, stomped on it, and slung it into the muddy river. For a while after, he stood there on the riverbank, smoking a cigarette. It's over, he told himself. It never happened. When he got home, he lowered all the blinds, double and then triple checking that he locked the door. He showered and crawled into bed. He didn't think he'd be able to sleep, not with how fast his heart was still beating. But he breathed slow and deep, laying there in the dark, and eventually he did sleep, if only out of pure exhaustion. When he awoke, he was swathed in darkness. He reached for his phone to check the time, but he couldn't find it. Hadn't he left it on the nightstand? He half lifted himself from a nest of knotted sheets, still damp from the sweat of some unremembered nightmare. He still couldn't see his phone, but as his eyes adjusted, he did notice something. The abysmal darkness of his apartment was broken by a faint glow emanating from his living room. Rolling tentatively out of bed, he emerged from his room to find that the glow was radiating from his TV. He stepped around the corner to see what was on the screen. As it came into view, he wished he hadn't. Somehow, the surveillance video footage of the woman in the house was playing on his own TV. The woman was standing at the bottom of the stairs, and just as she had been when he'd last seen her, she was staring directly into the camera, her eyes piercing and heartless. This must be a dream, he told himself. But if it was, it didn't seem like one he could wake up from. As he stared back at her, Remy noticed her lips begin to move. It appeared that she was speaking, but the video had no sound, so he couldn't tell what she was saying. He tried to read her lips, but he couldn't see her clearly enough to interpret the words. And for all he knew, she wasn't even speaking a language he'd recognize. Still, the subtle movement of her mouth unnerved him. Watching her deliver her indecipherable monologue filled him with a potent sense of dread. He stepped back from the TV, and as he did, he noticed the faintest hint of movement. In the entryway, behind the wall his TV was mounted on, something was creeping in the shadows. The entryway, like the rest of his apartment, was stiflingly dark. Only the areas that were touched by the glow of the TV had any definition. But his eyes had adjusted to the dark, allowing him to detect a suggestion of a presence in the entryway. He stared into the darkness and could just barely identify the outline of a shape, a familiar shape, barely distinguishable from the shadows surrounding it. The shape seemed to sway slightly, almost as though it was writhing. It was shockingly tall, and still hunched over to fit itself below the ceiling. Its spine, if it had a spine, had a sickening curvature, and long, thin appendages hung from its sides. The surface of it was dark and almost textureless, as if it was trying to replicate the empty black appearance of a shadow. At the top of it, Remy could see no head, just the warping of its frame to accommodate the ceiling. "Oh, fuck," he said, stumbling back a few steps. What happened next was not something he could fully comprehend. Like a pedestrian being struck by a car, it was too morbid and unexpected, and happened too quickly to be logically perceived in the moment. Remy knew there was movement, something twisting, spiraling through the dark. And then he felt a sensation that was like the popping of eardrums, sensed a strange warmth around the back of his head. And then there was nothing at all. Greetings, and thank you for listening to my podcast. While I've got you here, I just want to make sure you know I have a Patreon. It's $3 per new episode. You get to listen to every episode a few days early. You also get to listen without ads. Patreon subscribers also get access to my audiobook, Solace. It's sort of a mystery slash cosmic horror story. It follows this journalist who's sort of wrestling with this bizarre missing persons case. The Patreon also has its own RSS feed, so you can listen to it on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, whatever podcasting app you like. And there's a link to it in the episode description, as well as in the bio of the show. But if you can't see it, it's patreon.com/ACEPHALE. I also have t-shirts available. There's a few colors, some really cool designs. So if you like graphic tees as much as I do, pick one up. You can find them at aceofailhorrorfiction.com. There's also a link to that in the description. You can also follow me on social media. There are links to my socials in the description. And of course, you can leave a rating or review if you so wish. I really appreciate everyone who's done that. I am too sensitive to read all the reviews, but I appreciate that people write them, and I appreciate everyone who's reached out and said, this is a thing that I enjoy. So, thank you all for that. Good riddance. I will see you next time. Actually, I probably won't ever see you, but you will hear me, and hopefully enjoy it. Goodbye.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it, or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz. And how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.